Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Financial Services Practice Group, was recorded on June 20th, 2012, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call. My name is Paul Zimmerman, and I'm Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today we're welcoming a special guest moderator to our teleforum. Mr. John Douglas is a partner in the Financial Institutions Group at Davis, Polk & Wardwell, LLP, heading the firm's bank regulatory practice and focusing on bank restructuring and resolutions and other issues arising from the recent banking and financial crisis. He served as general counsel of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation from 1987 to 1989. Mr. Douglas, the floor is yours.
Thanks very much. We're going to spend about an hour talking about a question that seems never to go away, and that is whether we have really eliminated too big to fail. It is still timely. It's still a very interesting issue. We're watching events unfold in Europe that actually, to my mind, provide a real-life test of the willingness of the governments to impose a too-big-to-fail regime on their institutions. There are still lingering questions about whether the Dodd-Frank provisions enacted a couple of years ago really do provide a method for resolving our largest and most complex institutions. And I do find this question to be absolutely fascinating and raising a number of very important policy issues. I am delighted to be joined today by three panelists who know more about this subject than maybe any other three people in the world, which is nice. First, Professor David Skeel, who is the Samuel Arst Professor of Corporate Law at the University of Pennsylvania. Professor Skeel is, among other things, a prolific writer on bankruptcy, insolvency, Dodd-Frank-type issues, as a member of the European Corporate Governance Institute and a member of the American College of Bankruptcy. We also have with us David Skeel. David is regulatory counsel to the Institute for International Finance, a trade association of more than 400 of the largest and most active global financial institutions. The IIF has done tremendous work on trying to deal with cross-border, among other things, cross-border resolution problems, and has been a real thought leader in this effort. And finally, my partner, Randy Gwynn, who's head of our Financial Institutions Group, who is the brain power behind much of the Davis-Polk work and thought on single point of entry, use of RECAP as a resolution tool, using the Orderly Liquidation Authority. How could you actually, in practice, handle the insolvency of a large financial institutions? So this is really going to be interesting and fun. We're going to let each panelist start with a sort of short discussion of their perspective. Randy is going to give a bit of a background on the Orderly Liquidation Authority and kind of what it does and the FDIC single point of entry proposal. David Schrah will then talk about the international prospects for effective resolution regimes and some of the stuff that's going on, particularly in Europe, that is both fascinating and very timely. And finally, Professor Skeel will talk about whether there is a better way to handle the insolvency of a large, complex financial institution, tweaking the bankruptcy code to provide some of the things that Orderly Liquidation Authority purports to do, but perhaps in a more transparent and predictable fashion. And so I suspect the presentations will take a total of maybe 20 minutes, and then we will start probing some of the views of our panelists. So, Randy, let's start with OLA and kind of where the FDIC's head is these days.
Okay. Thanks a lot, John. So the first thing is that OLA sort of supplements what is already a special bankruptcy laws for insured banks. And in fact, if you look at the large institutions that are would be generally considered to be, or you know, to be systemically important or too big to fail. Almost all of them are bank holding companies with then a non-bank bank holding company and bank subsidiaries, broker-dealer subsidiaries, and so forth. What orderly liquidation authority is it's a new law that's designed to supplement the old law that applied only to insured banks. And, you know, I'm going to sort of address this by sort of answering seven questions. The first one was, what is it? The second one is, why was it enacted? And the answer to this is that during the recent financial crisis, as we observe, governments around the world, including the U.S., had a tendency to bail out the largest, most complex and interconnected financial groups. The government authorities said that they had no real choice in the matter because the only alternative to bail out was to allow one of these institutions to be undergo what they refer to as a disorderly liquidation, or basically failing under the ordinary bankruptcy or insolvency laws. But they believe that if they allowed these institutions to do that, that would result or could result in a collapse of the financial system and a catastrophe to the wider economy, such as excessive unemployment, low output, political instability, or even war. The Obama administration argued that this Orderly Liquidation Authority, or OLA, would give the regulatory authorities in the U.S. the power to wind down a systemically important non-bank financial company without risking such a collapse. Who does it apply to? The OLA potentially applies to any financial company that is not a bank or an insurance company, but it actually applies to things whether they're systemically important or not, and that's an important point. How is the new authority triggered? It doesn't apply automatically to non-bank financial companies. It only applies if the so-called triple keys decide that allowing a particular financial company to fail under a normal, under a particular set of circumstances, and if it was then run through the normal bankruptcy process, that would risk destabilizing the U.S. financial system, and that invoking OLA would actually mitigate or avoid that harm. The triple keys, just for those of you who are a little bit new to this, refers to the Secretary of Treasury, or maybe the keys held by the Secretary of Treasury, two-thirds of the Federal Reserve Board and two-thirds of the FDIC Board, who in consultation with the credit with the President decide whether to turn the keys or not. And if all three keys are turned, then OLA is invoked. And this means that the bankruptcy code, the Securities Investor Protection Act, the other normal bankruptcy laws should actually continue to apply in most situations except during a market meltdown such as the one we experienced in the fall of 2008, and probably only for the largest, most complex and interconnected institutions, although it's not, you know, expressly limited that way. So the question is, what in the world is wrong with the bankruptcy code? And I think we're going to have different views during the course of this call, and that will be good. Even the strongest advocates of OLA, certainly me included, admit that there's nothing wrong with the bankruptcy code 98% of the time. In fact, it's probably superior to OLA in 98% of the circumstances. But these advocates believe that OLA is needed during a genuine financial panic, such as the one that occurred in the fall of 2008. They believe that the ordinary bankruptcy laws are too slow and cumbersome during such periods. If financial institutions are liquidated or reorganized under the ordinary bankruptcy laws during these catastrophic periods, the liquidations or reorganizations will be disorderly. And what they mean by that, almost meaningless word, is that they would result in massive transfers of wealth and deadweight social losses that would fuel even more panic, runs on the financial institutions throughout the system, and severe contractions of credit throughout the system. And these severe contractions of credit can result in a collapse of the financial system and permanent harm to the wider economy. So in what way do the advocates of OLA think that it's any better than the bankruptcy code? And I'm going to focus on three things that are tools that don't exist in the bankruptcy code. First, OLA allows the FDIC to take value-preserving action faster than a bankruptcy court would be able to. For example, the FDIC has the power to create a new bridge financial company, transfer all of the systemically important operations and other viable parts of the failed firm's business to that bridge, but then leave behind enough liabilities in the old company so that the bridge has a strong positive net worth. The FDIC can complete this process over a weekend or even in a matter of hours. The FDIC can provide temporary funding to the bridge until the market becomes fully comfortable that it's a viable entity. And in this manner, the FDIC can preserve the franchise value of the business that's been transferred and avoid the sort of value destruction that could result from a fire sale liquidation. Second, the FDIC can prevent the immediate closeout of derivative contracts that caused so much value destruction in the Lehman bankruptcy. OLA imposes a one-day stay on such closeout rights so that the FDIC has time to decide whether to transfer the derivatives to the bridge. If it transfers them, there's a permanent stay on such closeouts unless the bridge actually commits an independent default, like a payment default. And third, the FDIC is able to deal with cross-border issues better than advocates think a bankruptcy court would be able to. The last question is, how will the FDIC use this authority to create a solution to the too-big-to-fail problem or the bailout problem, however you describe it? Well, the FDIC recently said that they would use it in a way to do what is referred to as single point of entry recapitalization. What does that mean? Well, they said what they would do is they would invoke OLA to put, say, the holding company of a financial group into receivership. They would then transfer all of the assets of the failed holding company to a new bridge holding company, and the assets would include all of the bank, broker, dealer, and other subsidiaries. In other words, all the shares in those companies. They would also transfer all the liabilities of the holding company to the bridge, except for equity securities and enough debt in the holding company so that it would be sort of left behind the receivership so that the bridge had a strong positive net worth. They would then issue equity in the bridge to a trustee. The trustee would run the bridge with input from the creditors left behind until all the provable claims could be identified and measured. The FDIC would then do an initial public offering of a portion of the securities issued by the bridge in order to establish a reliable market value for them. And finally, the FDIC would distribute the equity in the bridge to the claims left behind in the receivership in accordance with pre-existing priorities of claims. In effect, the creditors of the failed holding company would become the owners of the bridge company. What the FDIC would do, which is actually quite intriguing, is they would keep all of the bank, broker-dealer, and other subsidiaries of the holding company out of insolvency proceedings. So this avoids a lot of the most serious, we'll just say, issues with resolving an institution with global operations, which I think David Schraw will probably go into. This would also, or should also, eliminate or reduce the incentive of depositors or other short-term creditors at the subsidiaries to run. And if necessary to sort of prevent or stem runs, by strengthening the capital of these subsidiaries, the FDIC could cause the bridge company to swap any intercompany debt that it holds in the subsidiaries for new equity in the subsidiaries, thus recapitalizing them. Now, I said I was going to do seven questions. On the eighth, I just want to get it on the table, and that is, what are the weaknesses of OLA? Well, there are some, and they need to be addressed, but I am totally confident that David Skill will identify them, and we'll have a useful discussion about that. Thanks.
David Schraw, let's talk about international issues, which to my mind make this particularly difficult.
Okay, well, first of all, let me say a little bit about the Institute, which I don't know if people have heard about. The Institute of International Finance is 30 years old this year. It was originally organized to provide objective country risk analysis to the banks that were involved in the emerging market debt crisis of the early 80s, and continues to do that, but has subsequently expanded and now has a substantial amount of activity in both markets issues and in my department in advocacy of on regulatory issues at the international level. We certainly are not lobbyists. We don't do any kind of lobbying or generally advocacy at the domestic level, either in the U.S. or Europe or Japan or Saudi Arabia or any place else. But we do focus on what's going on with the international instances of the Basel Committee, the IAIS on the insurance side, IOSCO for securities, the FSB, the Financial Stability Board, et cetera, and that's becoming more and more important. Now, specifically on the resolution topic, we published three papers over time advocating, I think, pretty much exactly what Dodd-Frank actually advocates, which is that there should be no more bailouts, that a large financial institution should be able to fail in an orderly way without causing undue systemic disruption and without cost to the taxpayers. And in the course of those earlier reports, we, like a lot of other people, came around to the idea of bail-in, i.e., that a failing institution would be, in some respects, recapitalized by converting debt to equity to restore its capital position, as it overly simplified. So we come to this. Sometimes people are slightly surprised because we are an organization of large financial institutions. But I think it's very clear that our board of directors and all of the major institutions do want to end too big to fail, do want to avoid future taxpayer bailouts, and do see effective resolution as an essential component of that, along with appropriate increases of capital, internal risk management, et cetera. So that's by way of background for us. The essential international fact here is that the FSB published a document called Key Attributes of Effective Resolution Regimes for Financial Institutions in October of 2011. The Key Attributes develops a standard framework for national provisions on resolution of global firms. And they are, you know, sort of broadly congruent. We certainly would have some criticisms of details, but on the whole, we're pretty happy with that. It's congruent with our prior positions. Most importantly, the Key Attributes has mandates that all of the major markets establish a consistent set of resolution tools for banks, and that includes bail-in, importantly. In many ways, it's kind of an oversimplification and a little bit unfair, but I think it's also true to say that the Key Attributes were very largely inspired by the U.S. experience. The FDIC has a lot of respect in this area because of their long experience of resolving banks. And also the OOLA provisions were clearly a very important model for this. I think the FSB actually has done a very good job in setting out the basic outlines of what needs to be done in each country. We have just in the last 10 days or so published a new report, that in some respects is a response to the Key Attributes. It's called Making Resolution Robust, Completing the Legal and Institutional Frameworks for Effective Cross-Border Resolution of Financial Institutions. And although it's sort of hard to say all that at once, I think it does sort of show where we're at. We are very happy with the basics of the Key Attributes. We definitely advocate their quick enactment in all the major jurisdictions, but we are concerned that they have not perhaps done as much as they should have done to set international standards to mandate cross-border cooperation and coordination among the national authorities. They also are a little bit ambivalent and probably should be further developed on how to deal with different sorts of group structures. So the Key Attributes do have some good language on international cooperation and coordination, but the problem is that it's ultimately fairly hortatory and not mandatory. It leaves the door open for local authorities in resolving different parts of a multinational group to ring-fence assets. That's one of the things that has caused the most value destruction in the Lehman case, and is also a barrier to a fair result in a resolution, especially via bail-in. A fair meaning all creditors are treated equally insofar as they're consistently situated. So it's good as far as it goes, but it could go farther. Our new report, again, I want to stress, supports full adoption of the regime that's mandated by the Key Attributes in each country, but it should also take more actions to make sure that there will be internationally consistent organization of a failure of a bank, of a resolution, and not simply rely on good wishes, which is apparently as far as they felt they could go in this draft. We also stress, probably somewhat more than the FSB does, that resolution, and that by that I mean both planning for resolution in the so-called recovery and resolution plans that banks are required to do, and in actually carrying out a resolution, should be oriented to respect the economic and legal structures of the group that's failing, and also the circumstances of the failure. There is actually, contrary to what people think, quite a lot of difference of business model and organization across international banks. There are highly integrated groups. There are groups that operate on a universal banking model. There are also groups that are fairly decentralized, that operate locally funded, locally capitalized banks around the world, sometimes with minority interests. So there's a lot of difference that needs to be taken into account that was not fully taken into account by the FSB. Now, our paper tries to answer one of the major objections to resolution, which is that there are skeptics who say this will never work on an international basis. If you have to resolve a major bank over a weekend, how can you do that on an international basis, etc. We think actually those issues are solvable, and we've got 60 pages of report to try to demonstrate that. But we would like to see a little bit more ambition on the part of the FSB to make sure that there's a clear roadmap to achieve those achievable results that we think can be achieved. There's also a dimension of the FSB report that is actually an improvement over the original report, the original draft report that they did, but still they could go farther, which is that we stress that all of resolution planning and execution of resolution should have as its goals not only avoidance of systemic disruption, which is what they focus on now, but also maximizing recovery of as much possible value for creditors as can be achieved in the given context. And that's where bail-in, that's where the single point of entry technique that John mentioned come in. Too often there's a tendency, especially in the international discussion, to see the creditors, the senior unsecured creditors of the banks as these sort of evil investors who deserve to suffer in the failure. And although we would certainly agree that it makes more sense for the creditors to be bailed in than for the taxpayers to have to bail out an institution, we also focus on two things. One is that the creditors of banks are largely pension funds and insurance companies, which, to the surprise of some, actually represent important interests of society just as much as the taxpayers do. And secondly, we need to keep in mind the absolute need to create as much clarity and consistency as possible for the purpose of attracting ongoing investment in banks, not only in equity, but more importantly, in their senior unsecured debt. So focus on the possible outcomes for creditors, minimizing the damage that would be done to creditors is also very, very important. Now, there are all of the technical aspects of resolution that need to be thought about. There's the question of how to organize a resolution of a group with multiple legal entities. I think some of that needs more attention. It's a technical question. It's resolvable, but it needs more attention. Similarly, John didn't mention it, but there's a lot of discussion of stays of so-called financial contracts, such as derivatives, to make sure that those contracts could be continued by the successor or bridge institution under appropriate circumstances. And that's also a very important dimension that isn't always well understood, especially in Europe. I won't go into any more of those kinds of things in this discussion, except to say that I think one of the issues that we have, again, especially in Europe, is that there's a focus on the traditional hierarchy of creditors' claims against the estate of the failed bank. We advocate respect insofar as possible of that creditors' hierarchy. Is very important, obviously, that junior creditors get wiped out before senior ones, that security interests are respected, etc. But we also endorse very strongly the standard of fairness that the FSB has taken and adopted from the American practice of no creditor worse off than in liquidation, so that there is always a criterion of fairness that can be referred to, even if there are some rather arbitrary decisions that have to be taken under press circumstances in the weekend of resolution of a major institution. There is a standard of fairness, which is that almost any creditor will be better off in an orderly resolution with either a recapitalization of a successor or a transfer to a viable bridge than would have been the case in a layman type liquidation. I think that's very important because it's something that that the civil law professors tend to have difficulty with and needs to be promoted to them. Now, I won't say a great deal about what's going on in Europe now, but there is a very important legislative proposal that's been issued in the last couple of weeks by the European Commission on resolution. It is in many ways a good proposal. It would in many ways enact the FSB key attributes, so we're in favor of it from that point of view. But it does have some troubling points that will need to be debated and are really just beginning to be debated in Europe. One of them is that there are some very aggressive early intervention provisions under somewhat vague circumstances and well before the point at which a trigger would be pulled on a resolution. The authorities can appoint a special manager to take over a bank and throw out the management. That's something that is obviously troubling to a lot of banks and probably other people as well. There is the suggestion in a rather vague way that there would be a externally set minimum amount of bail-inable debt that a bank would have to carry. They mention as a suggestion 10% of total liabilities. We, in our report, stress the specificities of each group and argue that the planning for resolution of each group should be structured around the nature of that group, and the appropriate liability structure for a bank to make it resolvable needs to be determined with respect to its funding structure, with its business model in mind, et cetera, and that an external arbitrary amount of liabilities is not going to work, is not going to make sense. Also, quite troublingly, the European Commission proposes an ex-ante resolution fund of 1% of covered deposits that would be built up over 10 years. We have advocated in the past that while a resolution fund may be necessary to provide the resources necessary to resolve a bank, and there is in fact such a fund provided for in Dodd-Frank in the sense that the Treasury can lend the resolved bank the funds necessary, and insofar as those funds cannot be recovered from the bank, they would be recouped ex post from the industry. That is very much in line with what we advocated in our prior work. But the idea that the industry should be burdened at this time, when there's already very very substantial deleveraging going on in Europe, with another burden of 1% of covered deposits, I think is just very counterproductive and a very negative suggestion. There are some other things in the European suggestion, the European proposal that are interesting but need debate and may cause problems for international consistency and convergence. One of those is that deposit guarantee schemes, after they've paid out the insured depositors, would be subject to bail-in, pari passu with other unsecured non-preferred creditors. Now, that makes sense in many ways and answers the issue of what to do about deposit-funded banks, but it creates other issues, especially vis-a-vis the FDIC, and that's an issue that needs to be thought through, and I don't think anybody really has an answer to it yet. There are some other parts of the European proposal that are quite positive. It looks like the provision on cross-border resolution arrangements with third countries, i.e. with the U.S., could be very positive and could provide some of the missing mandatory character of cooperation that we feel the lack of in the FSB's paper. But we haven't really studied that enough to know if that's going to work as well as it might promise at first. So that's a kind of very rapid overview of the FSB, of the European proposal, and of our paper. And let me stop there. If anybody is interested in our paper, I guess they can contact the Federalist Society, and we will be happy to try to figure out how to send you either an electronic or a hard copy.
Terrific. When we get to predictability and transparency, orderly liquidation, in a sense, relies upon the ability of the regulators to almost act behind the curtain, which gets us to whether there might be another way or a better way to get predictability and transparency. Professor Skeel, you want to sort of talk about that?
Absolutely. What I thought I would mostly do is just briefly talk about Chapter 14, but I can't resist making a couple quick points before I start doing that. The first is that the single point of entry strategy that Randy was talking about and seems to be the emerging FDIC approach to using orderly liquidation is, in my view, it's a very creative interpretation of the resolution rules, but also a very interesting one. It's much better than I think what folks had in mind when the legislation was first passed. It does have a number of problems. So I just want to really, in my view, I just want to quickly and a little bit tendentiously flag a couple. One is it looks an awful lot like a bailout. The idea seems to assume that bondholders will take a haircut, but pretty much all other creditors will not take a haircut. Derivatives will be protected. Other short-term creditors will be protected. So it's not as bad of a bailout as we saw in 2008, but it does look a lot like a bailout. Second point about it is I worry that it could create some distortions in the financing market because derivatives and other short-term obligations are going to be protected. There's a huge incentive to use that kind of financing if you're a bank or other financial institution. And so I think there's a risk of continuing some of the fragility that caused problems in 2008. Finally, and perhaps most tendentiously, it seems to me that we want to be a little bit suspicious of any approach that all of the big banks are enthusiastic about. It makes me worry that this is a protect the big banks strategy. So that's my tendentiousness, or most of it. Very quickly on Chapter 14. Chapter 14 is a proposal that's been made by a working group at the Hoover Institution. The primary drafter of the proposal is Tom Jackson, a very well-known bankruptcy scholar for many years. There also are seven or eight others on the working group, and I'm one of the seven or eight others. The objective of Chapter 14 is to create a new chapter of the bankruptcy code, specifically with large financial institutions in mind. So just as we have Chapter 11 currently for ordinary corporations that run into financial trouble, Chapter 14 would be specifically for financial institutions, and it defines the financial institutions that would be covered as those who within their holding company structure have more than $100 billion in assets. So it's really designed only with the largest financial institutions in mind. The idea, and John has already alluded to this a couple of times, or parts of this in a couple of times, the idea is that the attractiveness of bankruptcy as compared to a resolution option is that the parties themselves are making the decisions. It's not regulators who decide ordinarily when to file. They're not the ones who are deciding who is getting what. So Chapter 14 would continue that. It would also have the kind of transparency that bankruptcy typically has. It wouldn't be done behind closed doors the way resolution is. And it would more naturally protect and preserve creditor priorities. So what is Chapter 14, or what would it do? Well, it would have a number of provisions that tweak the bankruptcy laws, again, with these large financial institutions in mind. And I'll just quickly mention, I think, four of them. One is that the primary regulator of the financial institution would be permitted to file the case, and they would be given a variety of other roles in the case as well. So although the institution itself would ordinarily decide whether to invoke Chapter 14, the authority would also be given for the regulator to put the institution into bankruptcy involuntarily if the institution were balance sheet insolvent. Second component of Chapter 14, and this is something that David alluded to, or David and Randy both alluded to a little bit, Chapter 14 would provide for a short stay on derivatives and other financial contracts. In bankruptcy as it currently stands, there is no stay, so the counterparty to a financial contract can grab collateral, they can terminate the contract, they can close out, they can do almost anything they want. Chapter 14 would impose a 3-day stay so that these contracts could not be terminated for a period of 3 days. Third provision is that some financial institutions that currently can't file for Chapter 11 would be able to file for Chapter 14, and the main example is brokerages. Currently, brokerages can only file for Chapter 7. This is why Lehman's brokerage did not initially file for bankruptcy. The holding company did, but not the brokerage. Chapter 14 would explicitly allow the brokerage to be part of the process. Finally, rather than using an ordinary bankruptcy judge, Chapter 14 would use a judge, an Article 3 judge, has in mind that a district court judge would be used, and the judge would be chosen from a panel of judges specifically because of her financial expertise. So there would be an Article 3 judge chosen with her expertise in mind to oversee the case. The original idea with Chapter 14 was that it would be a substitute for what later became Dodd-Frank resolution. The idea was this could handle the big financial institutions. We really don't need a new resolution regime. Dodd-Frank is now in place. Nobody seriously thinks that the resolution rules are going to be removed, although at least some people in the House seem to think that that's a possibility, but most people think we have read the resolution rules for better or for worse. And so now those of us who are proponents of Chapter 14 are proposing it as really as a complement to the resolution rules. So the hope would be that the vast majority of financial institutions, big financial institutions that ran into trouble would use Chapter 14 rather than OLA, but the assumption at this point is that OLA probably is not going to be repealed.
Terrific. Now, given that, Professor, assuming OLA is not repealed and we can't get Congress to do something with the Chapter 14, Are there kind of specific things you might like to do or like to see OLA tweaked a bit to make it more predictable or more transparent?
Well, there are a few things. I mean, there are a lot of things that I would probably like to do, and maybe we can get into some of them. Let me just mention three or four very quickly tweaks that I would make. The first tweak starts out with a tweak of the bankruptcy code that I've already referred to. I think that the automatic stay, a short automatic stay, ought to be applied to derivatives and financial contracts. And if it were applied, I think even ordinary bankruptcy would be more attractive than it currently is. I think the effect of this would be to give troubled financial institutions an incentive to file for bankruptcy. So my concern about OLA is it assumes regulators are going to make the decision, and historically regulators have tended to make that decision really late. And so I would like to tweak the bankruptcy code to add the stay, and then the tweak related to it that I'd like to make with Dodd-Frank is to make bankruptcy presumptive. So, let me articulate it differently. In the event a firm filed for bankruptcy, I would like to tweak Dodd-Frank resolution to say that that case presumptively would stay in bankruptcy. We now have exactly the opposite rule. Even if a financial institution files for bankruptcy, regulators can pull it out of bankruptcy. Dodd-Frank trumps. Second thing I would tweak is I actually don't much like the manager clawback provisions in Dodd-Frank. Dodd-Frank provides not only that the managers of one of these big institutions that fails would be kicked out, but that their compensation would potentially be clawed back for a period of years before bankruptcy. My concern with this is that it further undermines the incentive of the managers, the private actors in this process, to contribute to the system. If you're going to beat them, if the firm ends up in resolution, they're going to be kicking and screaming all along the way. So I think I would tweak that as well. A third change I would make is I would remove the thou shalt not reorganize, the thou shalt liquidate provision in Dodd-Frank. The single point of entry idea for using the resolution rules is, in my view, in considerable tension with the requirement that firms that go into resolution be liquidated. The requirement that they be liquidated seemed like a bad idea to me from the start. It's inconsistent with the way we've handled financial distress in every other industry for well over 100 years, and it really seems like a mistake here. I think we should leave open the option of reorganization. Finally, and this gets to where you started me, John, I would like to make a number of changes to add more due process to the resolution rules, starting with the difficulty of challenging a takeover under the resolution rules and continuing through the creditor protections. There are what look to be creditor protections in Dodd-Frank, but they almost all turn out to be illusory, with the result that the FDIC can pretty much do what it wants. And I would tighten those protections up.
Yeah. That's terrific. We are in fact open for questions, and there is a mechanism for you to let Charles or somebody at the Federalist Society know if you'd like to ask a question.
Yes, and I can, and this is Paul Zimmerman at the Federalist Society, and I can now open the floor to everyone's questions.
This is David. While you're doing that, David Shaw, let me respond to one thing that Professor Skeel just said, and that is that bail in Dodd-Frank OLA looks very much like bail out. I think that is, certainly from an international point of view, very, very much not the case. I think it's extremely important from a political point of view that bail in, i.e., the cost is imposed on the shareholders and creditors, is very, very different from bail out by taxpayer funds. Now, in the end, of course, society pays no matter whether you go bail out or bail in. But it is very important to maintain the distinction. And it's also very important to stress that one of the main purposes of bail-in, i.e. creditors pay, is to try to reinforce and make more real the market discipline on firms. And I think we're actually already seeing a good deal of greater market discipline in the senior debt market. So I think that's a very important distinction that I would not wish away. Also, with respect to predictability and transparency, we have some discussion in our report about ways in which regulators could provide the degree of predictability that we think investors want. We have an essay in our report that was done by some buy-side people, which I think talks about that rather eloquently.
David, one issue, which to my mind is really interesting here, we've talked a lot about bail-ins, but what we seem to be witnessing in Europe is a series of almost serial bail-outs. We've yet to see any of the governments attempt to impose losses on creditors. Do you have any perspective with respect to that?
Well, I think, you know, I think it's a little unfair to expect a new regime, new concept such as bail-in to be applied in you know, roaring crisis situations. First of all, amen. The legislative foundation for bail-in is not there. Secondly, I think there's a big difference between a problem with a single institution and what is in many ways a systemic problem that has as much to do with sovereign debt as it does with banks, in more so in some respects now. And thirdly, I think in a curious way, part of the Bankia deal, at least, is actually a bail-in. Now, it's a kind of funny kind of bail-in because the creditor that's being bailed in is the FRAB, the Spanish recapitalization fund. So I think it's actually premature and kind of falsifies the discussion of what's the best future resilient regime what do we do now to put out the fires? In other words, building the fire breaks for the future is not the same exercise as putting out the fire now.
Yeah. That's a very interesting question. And so that sort of gets me to my question to Randy. Will in fact OLA work in the time of a crisis? Would in fact the U.S. government, you know, would it work? And my view, which I'll express later, would the government ever do it twice?
Yeah. Well, I think it actually depends on how much time there is between now and when it might need to be used, and how diligent both the private and public sectors are in preparing for using it. I think, realistically, if you had a failure tomorrow of a major institution and we were in a crisis like we see sort of coming to the fore in Europe or that we saw in the fall of 2008, I just don't think people are ready to use it. And if they did use it, it probably would result in what you're alluding to, which is what a dumb idea. Who is thinking about this? Let's not ever use it again, or let's do a lot of change. But I think there needs to be a lot more working out of the details. I think there's going to be needed time for the institutions to prepare their living wills. The first round is in the process of, and for the regulators to kind of absorb the information. And there's going to need, although there's been a lot of progress made, there'll be a need for more cross-border sort of agreements between authorities so that this can all be coordinated. But I think that I'm more optimistic than you are that if there is enough time to sort of get the details worked out better, that I think it has at least as good a possibility as an alternative and I think would be superior to a bankruptcy code alternative, although I actually agree with a lot of the tweaks that Professor Skeel mentioned, and I actually would be very much in favor of bankruptcy code alternative to OLA, so that, you know, if the bankruptcy code were actually amended in ways that made it more feasible to do liquidations or reorganizations of financial institutions without causing the kind of harm that is a prerequisite to triggering OLA, I don't see how that would be anything but a good thing.
Yeah, I think it's also important to keep in mind that one of the purposes of what the FSB is doing, what we're doing, what I guess to some extent what the Commission is doing, is to create a body of law, not only a body of law, but a body of expectations about what's going to happen. That those expectations don't exist now, or they're the wrong expectations because they're bailout expectations. So part of the exercise now is to develop a resolution regime that one can look at and say, yes, that will work in theory, and then build on the basis of that, build the expectations across borders of all the different authorities that would be involved, that that's what would happen, so that when they get to that crisis weekend, those are the levers that they pull.
Yeah, all extremely interesting, and I really do find this fascinating, and I find the whole concept of entrusting this to the FDIC to be interesting. So it's a big leap of faith, I'm whenever you tweak around with the way the capital markets work, there will be reactions, and I don't think we understand OLA and what it means. And I think once we do it, we will see interesting reactions that are hard to anticipate right now.
This is David Skill. Can I jump in on that point,
yes,
John?
Yes, absolutely.
One concern I have is with the single point of entry approach, it looks like the major haircut would be borne, in addition to the fact that holding company shareholders would get wiped out, the major creditor haircut would be borne by bondholders.
Mm-hmm.
Currently, the big U.S. financial institution holding companies have lots of bond debt at the holding company level. The question I have is, will those bonds disappear as this approach evolves? And if they start to flee, or if bond finance becomes much more expensive for these big holding companies, what would we do next?
Yeah, I mean, I do find it fascinating. And the only, it's sort of interesting, the closest paradigm we have in the United States is the Washington Mutual bankruptcy, where the bank was taken away, the FDIC did its magic on the bank, and the holding company went through a bankruptcy proceeding. Interestingly enough, in that transaction, the losses were borne by the bank unsecured debt. The holding company debt, even the subordinated debt at the holding company level, has essentially been paid out at or close to par. And so in the sort of traditional way of handling a bank, losses are borne by the unsecured creditors at the bank level. And we saw after the Washington Mutual bankruptcy a flight of bank unsecured debt. In the OLA situation, it's reversed, right? Because if OLA had been applied to Washington Mutual, those losses would have been borne by the holding company debt, and the bank unsecured debt would have been protected. And as people begin to digest that, and you don't know which is going to be used, you may be affecting the pricing and availability of unsecured debt at both levels. I really do find it interesting.
Yeah, I think in the international discussion, it's very clear that there has got to be a cost to attaching bail-in to senior debt. And how much that cost and how dramatic that cost will be, one doesn't know. Our buy-side people were very clear that if there was enough clarity as to what would happen, if the expectations were firm enough, they can price anything. So they weren't too fussed about that. I do think that there are likely to be effects in the market, such as greater tiering of the stronger and the weaker institutions, et cetera. But I think there's also something approaching a consensus that although it will increase the cost of senior unsecured debt, it will induce, has already induced in Europe at least, a great deal of secured financing via covered bonds and other things. It's a necessary evil, if you will, because what's the alternative? The alternative is to leave the implicit state guarantee, and I don't think anybody's willing to admit that that's what they want.
Yeah, interesting.
Well, this is Paul Zimmerman. I'm wondering if we have time to take one or two questions here right at the end of the call. Would that be possible? Here's the first question.
John Rowling, Constitution.org. It seems that if we wait for a large enterprise to become insolvent, is too late. And most of these proposals seem to be intended to wait until a late stage in that process. Let me suggest that your Chapter 14 bankruptcy proposal could be expanded to provide a solution. And by the way, I hope you'll provide a web URL for it. And that would be to institute proactive bankruptcy, where large organizations could be broken up well in advance of becoming insolvent, and not just financial organizations, but large organizations of all kinds, so that the risk would be dispersed, and then perhaps to institute some other measure that would deal with herd behavior that might cause multiple organizations to act like a single organization with a similar effect, unless their strategies are dispersed.
Anyone have any comments on that?
This is David Skeel. I'm happy to jump in a little bit, and then you experts can take it from there. But just a couple of thoughts on that. I like the idea of an early bankruptcy process. Many years ago, I proposed what I referred to as a prepackaged form of bank insolvency, where the managers would be able to do a kind of preemptive bankruptcy filing. So I generally like that idea a lot. I think one concern with it might be a takings concern, that if you allow institutions to be taken over too far before they're insolvent, it may raise takings issues that don't arise in the same way if we wait until the institution is insolvent. So that's one thought. Another thought is, the as you may know, the banking laws were changed during the banking and S&L crisis of the late 80s and early 90s with something like this in mind, so that regulators are supposed to intervene before an institution is actually insolvent. So I think we have a little bit of a hint of that already in the bankruptcy laws, and I do think it's a good idea.
Jump in with this, David Shaw. Let me jump in with that, and I'd say I think it's, and I'm quite sure all of our members would think it's a very bad idea, for a number of reasons. First of all, as I mentioned, the European Commission has proposed something that sounds kind of like this. I think it's even more interventionist than either the prompt corrective action that we've got or the early intervention provisions of Dodd-Frank, and would allow the management to be thrown out and an administrator put in much earlier in the process than the point of triggering bail-in. I think it's also so that's an issue, something that we're very concerned about. You have to put this in the context of a huge amount of new regulatory requirements, capital, liquidity, intensified supervision, internal risk management requirements, governance requirements, a whole slew of other things that are intended to avoid banks getting to this situation. And, I think many of those things we support, although we think some of it goes too far. So, this is not just a resolution issue. There's a whole slew of other stuff going on there that needs to be kept in mind. But also, I think looking just at that proposal, certainly in the European version, the principal objection is that that again contributes to the disincentive for market discipline. It creates further uncertainty for the potential senior unsecured investors. They don't know at what point that early intervention would occur. Whether there be some sort of arbitrary state breakup of the firm. It doesn't allow market discipline to work, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there's a whole raft of objections to that would come out if it were
although,
to go seriously.
This is David Skeel. Presumably those same buy-side creditors who can price anything could price this too.
Well, it depends on how well defined, et cetera. That there's some truth to that. That's true. But I do know that some of our members are very concerned about the arbitrariness of what the commission is proposing.
Okay, well, it looks like we're about at the end of our hour. So, John Douglas, do you want to give a chance for closing comments from everyone?
Yeah, I mean, if I don't, Randy, David, if you anything you want to add here in our last moments?
The only thing I just sort of following last on that one point, which is, in fact, you know, the FDIC does have the power, at least under the bank resolution provisions, less under OLA, to intervene fairly early in the process, but. In experience, we haven't really seen that. They probably intervened much earlier in WaMu than they did in most of the other ones during the financial crisis. So there does seem to be a bias on the part of at least the U.S. regulators to, wait until an institution is pretty insolvent before they actually move in and query whether that's, that may not be any better of a balance than moving in way too early before insolvency.
David Skill, I'll just follow on that and maybe broaden it beyond where Randy would want to go. But historically, the tendency has been for firms, not just regulators with banks, but firms in other industries as well, to file for bankruptcy or for insolvency proceedings too late rather than too early. So measures that would push up the timeline at least a little bit, I think, tend to be desirable. I do agree that there is a point where you're pushing them in too early, but that has not been our tendency historically.
Terrific. Well, I do want to thank the panelists. This has been been really a great conversation, great dialogue, and this is an issue that unfortunately is not going to go away simply because we discussed it for an hour.
And on behalf of the Federalist Society, this is Paul Zimmerman, and I want to thank all our experts today, and especially John Douglas for moderating, and thank you to the audience, and I'm sorry to those of you whose questions we did not get to today, but it was a fascinating discussion nonetheless. Thanks so much.
Terrific.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.